welcome to this episode of the Wrinkled Engineer Podcast. The Overlord of Pronunciation tells us the plural of Prius. We have three small code topics to discuss today. Out-of-plane loads on interior partitions, wind load reductions for deflections for roofs and walls, and the sawn lumber repetitive factor. Tim's going to share a retrospective on the candlelight processional at Disneyland. We have a surprise authentic detail to discuss on Sleeping Beauty's castle, and Allie has an announcement. Welcome to the Wrinkled Engineer Podcast. I'm Gates. I'm here again with Allie and Tim. Thank you for joining us. We're going to hand this one over to Tim as the overlord of pronunciation. What is the plural of Prius?
Okay, so maybe some of you will remember this. There was a contest put on by Toyota a few years ago to answer this question. And they basically polled people. I think they gave five choices, but the one that got the most votes, and not by a gigantic margin, but like a reasonable winner, was Prii. So they decided to go with sort of the cacti octopi.
So it's not Prii. Priuses?
No, it's not Priuses, apparently.
How do you because by spell that?
I think there's two I's. I think it ends in two I's, if I recall.
So that leads me to, generally when I see a Prius, I call it a Prius.
In right.
A derogatory
Jeremy
fashion.
Jeremy Clarkson. Mm-hmm.
So.
Which is how he always referred to them, meaning derogatorily, yeah.
Yes, so Prius has worked for me.
It'd be a Prii.
Yes. Well, thank you for clearing that one up. So I wanted to talk about three mini topics today. I think three. There's three fingers. That I find are kind of interrelated because they're in the same boat, but they're not necessarily the same code issues. But they all have to deal with like floors or walls. So multiple studs or multiple joists type construction or large area loads. And the first comes from IBC section 1607.14, and it's the interior partition loading. So I think we joked that we disagree on this one a little bit. How do you apply that load, Allie?
As a wind load.
And how do you apply it, Tim?
As a live load.
And who's correct?
Me.
Okay.
No.
I've alluded to this before, that there are some things that bother me in the live load section, in that some live loads are listed as 200 pound live load, or it says the live load shall be, and in this paragraph the word live doesn't appear at all in it. It just says 5 PSF load.
It's so weird, and honestly, you know, it does make a bit of sense in terms of the source of the load, because it's, you know, it's not from wind, really. It's really meant to be like incidental loading, like people slamming into walls and things like that, which has more of a 1.6 kind of sound to it, to me. And the other thing about live load is, as a category, you're always supposed to do skip live load cases of every type of live load that you've got whenever it makes a difference. And I think that also makes sense with this, because that would mean that this live load is applied to walls by itself, or in conjunction with loading on the floors, or only loading on the floors in the absence of the loading on the walls. And all three cases should apply.
And I do agree that it's in the live load section, so it's totally a live load. It's not the way I was taught. I was taught that it was an interior wind pressure.
Everybody calls it that. I mean, just they call it interior live load. Or sorry, interior wind load all the time. I hear it all the time.
And you have things like this cabinet that's up here or back there that's inducing a moment onto my studs. And so having an aerial load is a good way to induce a moment. But really, Tim, the correct way to do it is a notional load, correct? Because
I think so.
It's not really categorized as anything specific. It's a theoretical load that we do just for stability and to make sure that you don't have paper-thin interior walls with no support. And the steel code handles it in the direct analysis method just fine with notional loads. I don't see why we couldn't transition notional loads into interior partitions.
Right.
And so I will still do it as a wind load, and I've converted it now to 8 PSF to account for the 1.6 factor difference between the 05 and the 10 code. But I still have to be careful, because if I'm in wood design, I get another 60% increase in strength for my CD value on my studs if I'm doing ASD, and that's not good. So I try and make sure that at least it equates out to what a live load would be. I recognize that in the code it's a live load. I think Allie's now been converted.
I was taught it was a wind load. So I was wondering, I was like, why is there wind inside a building?
You know, the air conditioners push so much air in that they're pushing. No, that's one excuse I've heard.
You'll hear people say that. You do.
Or you slam a door in a really airtight room, right? And that it's acting like a piston, so it's compressing the air or making a vacuum. But I like Tim's point that, hey, live load has different loading characteristics than a wind load.
And right.
So that makes all. So I'm converted now too. I will do it as a live load from this day forward. It just feels weird because you don't walk on walls. So, all right. Topic number one down. Second one from table 1604 in the IBC. 1604.3 is the deflection criteria for a bunch of different types of elements. And there's a footnote F in there. And footnote F allows you to reduce the wind pressure for just deflection on only exterior walls and roofs. And it's a substantial decrease. It's a 70% of the wind load. So it's a 30% decrease. That's back in the 06 code and the 05 ASCE7. That factor has now been changed to 0.42 to account for 0.7 times 0.6. So do you use this reduction or not when you're doing your alley?
I don't use it really. I mean, I just learned about it earlier this year on like the AISC conference. They had a serviceability one, and that's the first time I really noticed it. But I honestly don't take the reduction for deflection.
And Tim?
I haven't heard of it, honestly.
So
it's something that happens in California in particular, where we tend to pay less attention to wind.
Yeah. So I use this a lot, but I'm very conservative where I use it. I make sure that it's like a wall or a roof, and it's generally almost always in wood design where you're trying to get a 2x6 to span tall enough, and you're maybe even
24
form.
Feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've got, you know, in Florida, substantial wind loads, and you're probably not as concerned about deflection. It still meets the strength requirements. And in a hurricane, that's really all I care about. I'm less into the serviceability requirements. But for columns or frames or things like that, obviously those elements we're not talking about. But repetitive elements, absolutely, I feel like this is a valid method. Inconsistent, again, we see the code with not handling the virgin loads and the load combinations consistently. They allow a 0.42 reduction of the ultimate wind pressure. But if you were to throw that into an ASD load combination like you would normally do for your deflection design, you're going to get another 0.6 on top of it. That's not what the code wants you to do. This is a 0.6 reduction in the load combinations and then a 0.7 of the base wind pressure. But again, it's annoying, right? We're seeing it again in the code where you could get down now to 0.25 of the ultimate wind pressure and use that for
why
deflection.
Why are we even here?
Yeah, so don't do that. Please stop double dipping on your 0.6. You just got to be careful with that. Now, related to this, I would say, is the wood repetitive factor, or CR, from the NDS. So this allows you to increase the bending strength of repetitive members by 15%. Now, Tim, you said you didn't use this, right? Or you're not as familiar with
okay,
this
one. Here's my problem with this. Basically, what they're doing is giving engineers a cop-out for under-analyzing things. They're saying, all right, we're going to assume that you're not really looking at the system the way it's actually installed. We're going to assume that these studs, that you're analyzing the studs as though they're just free-flying and you're neglecting the effect of the sheathing. What else can you think of in the code where that logic applies, where they just ignore the assembly and assume that the engineer is not doing his complete job, and they just give you a reduction for like for nothing? They're like, okay, here you are. You're welcome for not doing your job. It just, it doesn't, and it presumes from a code level that they understand my assembly as well as I do. And there may be things about my assembly that don't make any sense about that reduction, and yet people can just take it out of hand. So I don't know. I'm not a fan.
But Allie, you use this one, right?
Yeah, I use it, and it's mostly for roof joists on wood, like single story wood buildings that are competitive that I use it for, which always get sheathed in plywood. I mean, I don't go into further analysis on it, so I guess I'll take that at face value.
Sorry, from my standpoint, the span squared over 3, you know, satisfies me from that perspective. I don't really see a need.
Yeah, for reduction of wind pressure.
Yeah, on the supply side and on the demand side. It's like, geez, you know, how many discounts are we going to get here?
Yeah, so I use it probably 80% of the time when it's applicable. And, you know, unlike the deflection criteria where there's only two conditions that it applies, exterior walls and roofs, this applies to any repetitive wood member that's within a certain size. I think it's 4-inch wide. So 4x and smaller are allowed to increase their bending capacity. The issue I have with it is that there's a lot of factors that go into deciding, is there load sharing occurring between the studs? For wind loads, I love it because, again, I think wind loads are high. And when you're trying to get a wood structure to work in a high wind region, it makes some sense to account for load sharing between elements. If those elements are really close together, like a built-up column, I totally get that too, because now wood being a natural material has a lot of variation. If I put 3 plies together, we have a better statistical analysis of what is going to occur in that group of studs. The odds of having a critical defect are now reduced from a single stud. So I don't mind the 15% increase in those situations. But when we're at 24 inches on center and we have sheathing, and we're saying that sheathing is going to share the load between all three of those members.
How thick is the sheathing?
Right. So now this is a flexibility problem between the flexibility of the joist and the flexibility of the sheathing.
Yep.
So if I have a really long span joist and I have 3/4-inch plywood over the top, but yeah, the plywood probably can get to the next joist because that center beam's going to sag so much. But if I have a relatively short span and a heavy floor, or even thinner plywood, is it really going to get there? The plywood's going to be more flexible than the joist? It's really what it comes down to. And so to me, that's why you can't just say, I'm going to use it all the time. And Allie talked about using this on roof joists. And I think trusses, I've seen truss manufacturers use this as well. Mm-hmm. In a place like Florida, where I have uplift and my nails are now in withdrawal, is that as good of a load sharing as it is when the pressure is positive and pushing the plywood into the member? I don't know. I don't know that it shares the load the same way. So use it as you feel appropriate, but I say about 80% of the time you're fine. I don't think drywall is an effective means of transmitting loads to studs. And in the NDS, it tells you that plywood's acceptable as a sheathing material and other forms of decking. And I have heard other comments that the studies don't necessarily back up that the load is shared.
That's the thing. And you said this is an IBC line.
Well, this is an NDS, so it's in the wood code, but it's been in there forever.
The wood code.
It's been in there for a long time.
And, you know, We're hypothesizing a bit here. It would be nice to see the referenced studies that prove one way or the other, because I think in any one of us, once you lay out the study and the results, we're going to accept the results, whatever they are.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things I feel that it's in the code and people either know about it and use it or they don't know about it. But our education about it isn't as solid as some of the other things. And I think all three of these topics are that we talked about today, not that they're unclear, but there's potential for mistakes or to apply it in the wrong situation if you don't read the footnotes and you don't only apply it to the situations that it says you can. And as always, you have to watch that 0.6 factor on wind loads. We're never going to get away from it, I'm convinced.
No.
Well, it's almost Christmas time. We've got, 4 days to Christmas? So, Wow. Yes, since the three of us all like the Disney parks, and I think we all miss candlelight, the candlelight processional at Disneyland and even at Disney World, though it's not quite as good. It's not as grandiose of a production, that is for sure.
I have a lot of opinions about that.
And you can feel free to share those. So the advantage of having Tim on this show is that Tim has sung in the choir how many years?
Let's see. I've done over 20 shows. The first time I performed in it was in 1989.
So to help.
Ellie's eyebrows shoot up. She's like, wait a second. Yeah, I wasn't alive then.
There's a lot of events that Allie was not alive for that you and I were alive for, Tim. So in the absence of candlelight this year, I thought it'd be good to get your retrospective on singing in the choir and what makes this event such a wonderful thing to have and just a tradition that'll hopefully go on after this.
Yeah. I mean, no one's really worried about that, assuming that the parks reopen at some point. But it's something that we've been doing since the park opened in the 50s. And it's the largest show that is done in any Disney park, you're looking at about 800 performers in one show, which is something that it has over the Walt Disney World version, which has a lot more smaller shows instead. So at Disney World, it's done, well, originally it was done in front of the castle for until Epcot opened. And I think a couple of years after Epcot opened, they switched it over to the American Adventure Gardens Theater. And they've been running it there ever since. And of course that theater limits the size of their show. At Disneyland, they set up bleachers all over the train station and basically use Town Square as the theater, because the entire center of Town Square is filled with audience. The orchestra is, in the front center, and then the choir surrounds it up on the train station. There's some really good pictures of it available, obviously, and videos are posted every year. But we have the cast choir that does the Living Christmas Tree in the middle of the show, and it's surrounded by invited choirs who audition to be in the show. And I think, what did they say? It's about, I don't remember the ratio, but it's quite small. It's like 1 in 10 or smaller that gets accepted to the show. So the guest choirs who get invited from high schools, from universities, from churches, around Southern California, they're very good. They're very good. And the orchestra is professional, and we have a conductor who's a professional caliber conductor and a celebrity guest narrator. And the show is done for the community. We don't sell tickets to this show. It's in the park, so obviously if you're in the park, you paid to get in. But the show itself is not exclusive from a ticketing standpoint. the seats are only given away to people who are invited by Disneyland to come see the show. So it's always interesting for me standing up there singing the show, kind of scanning the crowd there in front of me to see, you know, who's sitting there, because I'll recognize various executives, various people from you know, the community and stuff like that have been invited to see the show. But it's about a 45-minute show, and it's really complex chorally. I can tell you it is not an easy show to sing, and I've been in a lot of choirs. It's interesting. I really enjoy doing it.
Absolutely. So one of the big differences I noticed between California and Florida is that I can go to Epcot and I can wait like an hour. I can get a seat for Candlelight.
Yeah.
It's not really the case at Disneyland.
No, it's about 4 hours for Disneyland, I think, is about right.
And I had the one time that I've seen Disneyland Candlelight was during rehearsal. That was the only way I got a seat.
Yeah. We do 4 shows at Disneyland. We do 2 on Saturday and 2 on Sunday, the first weekend of December.
And so
to a lot more, closer to 20 in Florida.
Yeah, they do it every night for like the whole month.
And
it's really fun to watch Candlelight at 2 o'clock in the morning.
It's a
very unique experience. And you alluded that there are, you know, guest hosts or celebrities who come in and do the reading portion.
Right, the narrators.
And the cool thing about doing the rehearsal is they're not there for it.
Correct. We have a stand-in.
and to me, the stand-in doesn't get any better than... it's not Mickey Mouse, but the stand-in does not get any better than the celebrities.
That would be close. Bill Rogers, the voice of Disneyland, the guy you hear booming over the speakers announcing that fireworks are going to start in 5 minutes, or, you know, any of the other things that they announce. he's standing there at the podium live doing the reading of the show, which is also weird for us because he's always recorded in most of our lives, right?
Well, and so, it's the voice you hear throughout the day at the park, and you've heard it for decades. So who better to narrate the Candlelight than the man you hear all the time?
Now, let me tell you a little about him. He is, I mean, we all know Disney fans. He is a huge Disney fan. He absolutely adores his job. And the park and the people who work there and stuff like that. And he, whenever he's done with the show, every year he gives us kind of a new speech. I don't know how he manages to keep coming up with them, but basically his expression of what that show means to him and what us as cast mean to him. And it's the nicest thing. Is just you look forward to hearing that every year because it just makes you feel so good, you know. But he's the nicest guy. And when he's doing the reading, he's better than any of our guest narrators because, I mean,
you know, that's what he does.
He's the man as far as that's concerned.
Professional,
and he's got more practice than any of them because he's done it so many years, right? So, he's fantastic, and that's a special treat for us because, like I said, we're the town square is empty, and we're the only ones who get to see him do that. It's not recorded or anything like that, so it's just something where you kind of have to take our word for it.
Yeah, it's very cool. And then, side note, his wife is the voice of California Adventure, which is that's just
I
so
love
cool.
That they're married.
Yes, it's very convenient. And of course, we kind of left Allie out on this discussion because she has not had the opportunity to see Candlelight, so she's gonna have to get.
She wants
it.
To now.
Yeah. I do want to. I was gonna say, how many cast members are in the show?
We have in the cast choir, there's between 300 and 350, and we break the choir into roughly 4 pieces for the 4 shows. So, 130 per show, something like that.
And you guys all have to audition?
Am I doing that the wrong way? 75? Yes. What's that?
You all have to audition for it every year?
Yeah, well, you have to audition the first 3 years, and after you've been admitted for 3 years, then you don't have to audition anymore.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think I would make it, but that's okay.
You know, it's fun too because you see cast members that you didn't know that they were singers, and there they are in the choir.
Yeah, so. It's crazy because, I mean, you know, who do you have up on stage with you? A bunch of people who, you know, sell tickets in the ticket booths, or popcorn, or run Space Mountain, or, you know, it's just any type of cast member who works there, any of them, you know, guest relations, they're all there. It's pretty funny because then you'll see them throughout the park, and it's like, we're kind of like a secret fraternity because we know who each other is, you know.
Yep. Like, engineers and architects seem to make
even,
it, so.
Even them, yeah. Yeah, we have an architect from a former, from the department that we were all in, who went to WDI, who is also still in the show. So it's pretty cool.
It is a cool tradition, and it's awesome. So before we started, I sent each of you, I texted you a picture from inside of Disneyland. And this is something that Tim pointed out to me. And I think we were walking out of Frontierland, and we took a left to to take the West Bypass around the castle. Now, Allie, do you know what that picture is of? And it's on the screen now, so everybody can see it. Do you have any clue what that is?
No, the castle.
It's part of the castle, so you must not have been with us. I think there was another structural engineer architect who was walking. And Tim pointed this out and said, "You'll never look at the castle the same way again."
Isn't it? Yeah, I think I was there for this one too.
I tried to give the tour to as many people as I could, and I usually talk about this. Now, the point of me talking about this is I'm pointing out a lot of the features on the castle that are genuine medieval defensive features.
I always point out the murder holes
when you
hate that you showed me those. I'm like, look at, you could die from these.
Exactly.
We might have to get a picture of those too.
This one in particular is a bathroom, and this is where you would take the chamber pot and basically cast it out the window into the moat. So it's funny because at Disneyland it's right above a walkway. Walk fast through that area, yes, just in case somebody's feeling like being authentic.
It had a very Monty Python feel to it as far as
what was
going on with this. And yes, the fact that there's a walkway underneath the restroom that does not have plumbing brought a smile to my face. And now I'll never forget. Now I can't look at the west side of the castle without being like, oh, there it is. Well, I think that's all I've got for today. Any other thoughts? Anything else going on for Christmas?
No, it's completely dark now, so I'm ready to see my convergence of Jupiter and Saturn, which is tonight.
Yes, so I saw that 3 hours ago or 2.5 hours ago on the East Coast. It wasn't much, just two really close together dots.
Two little dots, great. Looking forward to it.
So that is today, yes, the convergence for the next 24 hours. Well, thank you for joining me. I hope that you guys have a Merry Christmas, and
thank you.
Get some time to relax, and I don't know, do whatever. I'm going to be video editing, so. So you thought we were done, but we forgot one item of a business here. Allie has two announcements, but she's only going to give us one of them.
I passed the PE exam, woo!
Yay!
And a shout out to Denise. She also worked with us and she passed her PE exam in California. So which state did you take it in? Did you take it in Illinois?
Yeah, I took it in Illinois.
And you took the civil PE?
Yep.
So that's weird. In Illinois, you're supposed to take the SE. You don't have to take the PE in Illinois.
Yeah, but I work in Missouri though, so.
Oh. Okay.
And I can't apply for another year anyway in Missouri.
All right, well, start studying for the SE. Highly recommend it. Well, congratulations. Thanks. So now we're saying goodbye.
Bye.
Have a good night. Good one.